Funding for the Think Podcast comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safe every day. Preventing workplace accidents can help build a stronger, safer Texas. More at texasmutual.com.
It's hard to fathom starting over after a period of homelessness, finding a place to work and a place to live with virtually no possessions at the beginning. How many paychecks would it take before you had a bed, a couch, a microwave, or TV? But even starting from nothing is preferable to what happens to some people who emerge from time without housing and discover their bills have been mounting even while they were living on the street. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Lori Teresa Yearwood found herself without a place to live after a series of bad breaks in her life. Her house burned down. She struggled emotionally after her mother died. She lost the business she'd started. When she was finally able to get back into a home and a job about 2 years later, she found herself confronted by enormous debts. The IRS wanted penalties on taxes she'd already paid years earlier. Later, she had an outstanding bill for a hospital stay in the wake of a series of assaults she suffered while living on the street. Today, Yearwood is a reporter covering housing for the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Her recent essay, published in the New York Times, is headlined, "The Bill for My Homelessness Was $54,000." Lori, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Good to be here.
I think it's easy to make the mistake of assuming folks who end up unhoused have led lives that would be somehow unrecognizable to those of us lucky enough never to experience this, right? But it sounds like you had at least a middle-class childhood. You had a good education. You had a career. Tell us about your life before so many things went wrong for you in such a short time.
Well, I was a reporter for the Miami Herald for 7 years. And before that, I was a reporter for the Syracuse newspapers. And before that, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. So a graduate with a college degree. I left journalism to start up a business. And then the Great Depression, the Great Recession happened. And I lost my economic footing, was able to stay relatively stable and pay for my life until my house burned down. Then my mom died very unexpectedly. And also there was a big family battle over inheritance. So there was ostracization going on. And I really lost all footing then. So that was the tumble. It took about a year.
I'm so sorry all that happened to you. For a while, you were able to stay with friends. What do you remember about the first time you found yourself in a shelter?
The horror of it, the inhospitability of the shelter, its lack of conduciveness to any kind of self-care, like sleep or taking a shower, the lack of safety. I was stalked at the shelter about 2 weeks into checking in by a man who worked at the shelter, who began stalking me and then abducted me and then sexually assaulted me for about a year.
It must have felt unreal to you how recently you had had a life like everybody else's and how quickly you were plunged into this incredibly difficult set of circumstances.
Yeah, I think unreal is a good word. It was a lot of trauma. And so in that trauma, I did what many people do, which is I disassociated from my reality and froze, which is a very common trauma response, especially under, sexual assault.
And did those assaults feel like something you didn't have the power to report?
So I think to answer that question, you have to kind of consider the context of a person's homelessness, their vulnerability. When you are unhoused and you're surrounded by an unsafe environment, you're extremely vulnerable all the time. So you can't go in your house and collect your thoughts or your car. So yeah, the fact that he was standing at the shelter doors for every morning and following me and then assaulting me made me feel like prey and very frightened. Yes.
I think your story points to one of the great ironies of being unhoused in the United States, which is that a lot of people are sort of vaguely afraid of homeless people they encounter on the street. As a person without a home, you're in danger pretty much all the time, right?
Yeah. So my definition of homelessness is trauma. So it's ongoing trauma all the time. It never stops.
This trauma caused you to be largely unable to speak. And I wonder what that felt like, the inability to explain yourself or communicate about what you needed.
Yeah, it's quite ironic, given that I had made a living as a communicator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, you know, and interviewed lots of high profile and sometimes famous people, as well as people who weren't famous. But to go from that state to not talking is indicative of being in the most trauma that a person can be in. That is a very, that response means that the trauma level has exceeded any ability to cognitively cope with it.
So you had traveled the world in your earlier life, including in your life as a journalist. When you were homeless, you explained that your world became much, much smaller.
Right. So it shrunk to a circumference of about 2 miles. And I was being stalked. And I think that the important thing to note here is not exactly the details of my experience, but the underlying manifestation of what occurs to people who are experiencing severe trauma without a break.
Yeah.
So the brain goes into reptilian mode. The nervous system shuts down to anything other than survival. There is no ability to do any kind of long-term planning. It's just what's in front of you. Where are you going to take your next shower? Could you possibly find a place to sleep? Is the person who you are trying to flee stalking you in the moment? So these are the kinds of circumstances that I don't think people who are housed and have never faced being unhoused think about, that state that is constant.
Of course, you were the same person you'd always been, right? Same bright mind, same experiences. What did you learn about the parts of yourself that became invisible to other people once you were homeless?
Can you say that another way?
Could people see you as a full human when you were on the streets? Did they treat you like a human?
No, I think that's what we do to the unhoused, is we dehumanize them and then we criminalize them because we dehumanize them. So that also leads to disassociating from your suffering because it's just too extreme.
So it is not illegal to be unhoused, but we have all kinds of laws to criminalize the realities of an unhoused existence, right? How did you end up in jail?
I would disagree with you that it's not illegal to be unhoused because,
okay.
Yeah, because, for example, in Texas, in May of last year, a ban on all public camping took place. So people, if you don't have a place to go, let's say the shelter's overflowing or someone is standing outside the door stalking you, and the only place that you can go is a park bench, and that's illegal, then in that instance, homelessness is illegal. So I ended up in jail for taking a bath in a public river because I felt that it was very unsafe for me to stay at the shelter.
Lori, I think a lot of us imagine that if someone like you, someone who has been unhoused, gets into housing, gets a job, great, this is a happily ever after story and we can stop worrying. This didn't turn out to be your experience exactly, but first tell us how you were able to get off the street and into an apartment.
So after 2 years of hell, I decided against my all my hesitations to walk down to the place where the services were offered to the unhoused, where people would congregate, but also where the stalker hung out. But I decided one day that I was going to go down there. And so I did, and through a series of wonderful events, I met a really nice person who drove me to a church, who introduced me to a pastor, who connected me to a woman by the name of Shannon Cox, who is a former police officer and the founder of an organization called Journey of Hope. And she just immediately normalized what I had been going through in terms of trauma, which helped me feel less judged and ashamed. So, and then I began telling her about this man, and she just was this amazing person who said, you know, almost every woman I've ever met who's been homeless has been sexually assaulted, and this is the response, and this is how your brain works, and it's not your fault. And she put me in a temporary home where I oversaw a group of women who were coming out of incarceration. Most people who are unhoused also experience incarceration. That's part of being homeless. And I was there because I don't have any substance abuse issues, and she thought that I could help oversee these women. So I was like made a house mom, which was wonderful. I stayed there 6 months and then found a place to rent a one-bedroom apartment from a college professor. And then after that, rented my own apartment, and I've been here for almost 4 years.
What had happened to your credit rating during the time you were on the street or in jail?
Well, so I had a good credit rating before I became homeless. As we said at the beginning of the show, the homelessness happened pretty quickly. You know, it was like a snowball effect. And so it was really good. And then I think it was about 730, which is considered a prime score. And when I came out of homelessness, it had gone down into the low 600s because of ambulance bill debts, nearly 4,000 in ambulance bill debts, which I was able to overcome through a credit agency and through journalism, writing about my experience with that. And then I thought everything was okay. And I was stabilized, and then I got another letter from the IRS saying, well, you owe $2,300 on penalties for taxes that you paid. And I reached out to the man who was my CPA before the homelessness. And he's like, this is insane. His name is Scott Peck, and I owe him a lot. I'm very grateful to him. He's out in California. And he said, what were you supposed to do? File your taxes from the storage shed where this guy had abducted you? And so he wrote to the IRS, and they denied the request. And he was just, he went after it like a dog with a bone. And he filed an appeal, and then they finally accepted the appeal, and then that went away. And then I thought, okay, I'm finally over all of it now. I can rest. I can relax. You know, I've been working. I started out as a grocery store clerk, got a job at EHRP as a contributor, you know, was steadily working my way back into life. And then last year, I got a bill from the hospital after the sexual assault saying you owe us $48,000. My credit dropped again. And I was really upset. I don't know if you can imagine getting a bill for $48,000.
I can't. And yeah. I've had a job the whole time. I can't.
Yeah. And I said, well, you know, I was homeless. So why didn't you write it off as charity or write it off to Medicaid, which is traditionally what is done? And they said, well, we didn't know you were homeless. And I said, they said, you refused to talk. So they were kind of doing the blaming the victim thing, which was really upsetting. I was furious and wrote to my editor, David Wallace at EHRP, and he was like, channel this energy into a story, you know? So I said, you know, I have found these notes and I have proof from at least two doctors that you did know I was homeless. It's very obvious in their notes. And I'm writing a story about this. And so then they retracted the debt and made it go away. And now I'm thinking everything's finally over. Yeah.
Are you a little afraid to say that at this point, having experienced this?
I can't. I've really racked my brain thinking, is there anything else? But I don't. I honestly, knock on wood, I don't think there is. But the experience with the hospital was extremely disturbing because I think it shows the way that we treat unhoused people. I mean, as being assuming that they're unable to fend for themselves. You know, I had gone and gotten my records at the beginning of my emergence because I was writing a story for the Washington Post about it. And Shannon, who has become a friend at Journey of Hope, went with me to each hospital to get the records. So I had it waiting, and I don't know how many people who have gone through what I've gone through, unless they are journalists, would have done that.
Yeah, like not everybody has those resources or those contacts.
Right, or just the thought to go get all their records, right? That requires, I mean, I did it because I was writing an in-depth story for the Washington Post. I needed it. So I don't think I would have done that.
You've learned from your reporting, talking to other people, that there are lots of ways unhoused people continue to accrue debt. There are child support payments that build up. There are all kinds of things that continue to happen to people even after they have virtually no way of paying these bills.
Yeah, so the most common things are like electric, gas, cell phone, that kind of thing. Definitely child payments, jail fines. Those are very common. Hospital, a $48,000 hospital bill. I've met several formerly unhoused people who had that as well as what I had with the ambulance debt. It's not hard to find. You just walk into a group of unhoused people and say, is anybody here dealing with debt? And someone always says yes.
You write about how hard it was to trust people as you were unhoused and working your way out of this. How did that affect the way you interacted with people? For example, you mentioned it took a lot for you to go to this agency that was supposed to help people, in part because one of the staffers there had horribly abused you.
For a year. Yeah.
You also found a lot of nonprofit groups working to help care for unhoused people are not sort of trauma-informed. Can you talk about what trauma-informed care would look like for agencies trying to help people experiencing homelessness?
So my model for trauma awareness is Journey of Hope and Shannon, because she has gone through a lot of trauma herself, and she has worked for the FBI and teaching them about trauma awareness. And so she, one of the first things you do is you normalize the person's really unusual circumstances, you know, so you don't, you take the shame away. So nobody had ever said to me, you know, like, what happened to you? And then when I was quiet, no one had then followed up with, well, you know, 99.9% of women are sexually assaulted on the streets. And there was just something very empowering about that information, because I didn't feel ashamed. And then I started to talk to her. So that was extremely trauma aware. She was taught me to reframe things, right? Like, so yeah, you've been through hell, but you also are here. You are very resilient. So it wasn't focusing on the pathology of a collapse. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with you? Why mm-hmm. did you collapse? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? It was, hey, you made it. You're here. Oh my God. She looked at my website I had at the time, and this was almost 5 years ago. And she said, you're a writer. You're going to write again, you know? And she latched onto my potential and the good things in my past. And she took action. She got me a house to live in.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Lori, what did you learn about the system the Department of Veterans Affairs has set up to help unhoused vets get past the kinds of accruing bills and fines and fees that may be charged to them?
Well, Dennis Culhane, the professor at, this is slipping my mind, the university where he's from, but if you have it in front of me, please feel free to add it in. But he made me aware of that and then said it's not, you know, it's not as wide of a scope as it could be. And we need more of these places. And I feel that it would be a great idea. But I also think we need people like to help, like it's called a soft handoff. So they would, like, for example, the pastor at the church took me to Shannon, had to drive me there. I wouldn't have gone on my own because by that point I had stopped trusting people. And Shannon then in turn told me about AAA Fair Credit. And so there's going to have to be like a soft circular handoff. It's not like you just build it and they come.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dennis Culhane's at the University of Pennsylvania, by the way.
Thank you.
I think the fascinating thing is that I think about all the other people who could, with a great deal of hard work, they could regain their lives, but they need someone to believe that's possible to sort of extend that soft handoff.
Yeah. So I take a little umbrage too with a great deal of hard work, because I've been told that a lot.
Forgive me. I meant it's not easy to get back. I'm really sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. It's a tremendous amount of work that is, it's really hard. So, because after you've imagined, you've been through a year of sexual assault, almost a year of incarceration, and you come out of it and people say to you, now, I'm glad you said it, because they say, okay, now work really hard. And you do need somebody to help you and light that spark. And it's not going to be that answer. It does have to come from within. And, you know, one of the reasons that I think I was able to do it was the help of other people, but it was also because I had been middle class. Mm-hmm. Like, I had experienced a lot of success and I knew what that felt like. And a lot of people who are unhoused don't know what that feels like. So they don't have that reference point. So, I think I'm really lucky in that way. You know, I know what it is to be treated fairly, to be paid well. And I'm not going to stop until I get back to the point of where I think I need to be, because I have a great deal of self-worth. A lot of people coming out of those circumstances don't.
Do you feel like that self-worth could have been entirely evaporated if you had been out there longer?
Yes. Yes, I think that it was a grace, that absolutely divine grace that got me off that park bench. That I still can't explain it, but absolutely. If I had gone just a little bit further, I think I'd either be locked up in some state institution or dead.
What do we know about why rates of homelessness are still rising in the United States? What are we doing wrong for people who need help?
Well, that's a great question. And I'm not sure I have all of the answer, right? It's very complicated. But I would say that we focus too much on the pathology of the person who has collapsed. And we need to turn around and look at ourselves, like you just said, and say, what do we need to do differently? Why are we doing this? You know, like the woman who said she was the queen of, and I was her project. I think she meant well, right? Like, she was giving me a low rent, an affordable room to rent, and she felt good about that. But we need to look at what our, why we're doing what we're doing, why we're quote unquote helping, what we're expecting from the people we're helping. You know, are we expecting them to be meek and not be angry? And so I think we need a lot more trauma awareness, not just about the people who have collapsed, but about ourselves. Because how can you encompass somebody else's collapse if you can't encompass your own trauma? I think we have a long ways to go. And currently in the 70% of all extremely low income families pay more than half their income on rent. That's an abomination. Nobody can live like that and sustain that and be okay.
You've also reported on people. It's really extraordinary. You wrote about a woman who is preparing to have to live in her own van because things are not going well for her. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's a column that I'm writing called How Are You Coping With That for Defector.com. And it was my attempt to focus on people's resilience and coping skills in the face of great challenges. Mm-hmm. So I think the fact that she's preparing a van to go sleep in, it is really sad. And, you know, she's not young and she's got some health issues. And that is one aspect of it. But I also, my hat is off to her for preparing a way for herself to survive. So that's strength-based journalism. That's what I'm trying to do, is make people full human beings. Because, you know, right now I'm working on a story about eviction and people are living in their cars and, you know, one woman has three children scattered across the city and she's living in her car and she has to go to each place and she's working at a pawn shop. And it is devastating, but I also want people to notice, if they can, that she's trying the best she can to cope with all that. And it takes a lot of determination.
It sounds absolutely exhausting to try to take care of your kids in multiple locations. And it's hard to imagine that anybody can do it.
Well, they can't. So, but I think that we need to start seeing people who have collapsed as full human beings, right? So I don't want to rant, but everyone is going through such extreme amounts of hardship. And we need to look at how that's when you talked about trauma awareness. That's part of what we need to incorporate into our views of people, instead of just the only the judgment that says, my God, what did you do wrong that made you, that has put you out on the street?
How does that trauma you survived affect your life today?
I think I'm much less likely to put people into boxes. I'm much more trauma aware about other people's circumstances as well as my own. Anybody who knows me knows that I don't let people give me any kind of identity that they think that I need, that I have who I am. So it's actually, I'm using it to make myself into a very strong journalist who can help others and ask the right questions.
Do you have anxiety about your financial future?
Well, I'm 56, right? So I finally have saved up an emergency fund. I have a 401k that I contribute to. So I think I'm like a lot of Americans, you know, where I feel that it's imperative. I move quickly, but I'm in a decent place at this point.
Where should agencies, cities, government entities concentrate their resources to have the maximum effect for folks who are unhoused?
I think places that offer what is called wraparound care. So like what Dennis Culhane from the University of Pennsylvania was talking about in a legal sense, I think we need that so that when a woman or a man comes in, they can get help, financial help, not just food, not just clothing, but a safe place to live, not just any place to live. And for me, looking back, I wish there had been more awareness about the financial trauma that I was going to go through. Right. So that would have been hugely helpful. Just because you have a house doesn't mean you're stable.
Yeah.
Not if you're $54,000 in debt. It's a fallacy.
When you meet somebody now who is unhoused, not as part of a story you're working on, but just as part of everyday life, how do you interact with them?
I try to look the person in the eye. If I'm offering food, I say, I don't just offer food. I say, what would you like? You know, if they're hanging out in front of a grocery store or a fast food restaurant, I say, if you could have anything, what would you like? And then I go get exactly what they want, as opposed to assuming. And just once in a while, I say my name and I might say I understand. It depends on how open they are to a conversation.
Lori Teresa Yearwood is a reporter covering housing for the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Her recent essay, The Bill for My Homelessness Was $54,000, was published by the New York Times. Lori, thanks very much for telling your story and spending this time with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. The podcast is free where you get your podcast. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.